Welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast on Rethinking Sex Education. Each week on this podcast, I post some thoughts to help get a conversation started about hammering out a viable, a helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality. I hope you join in. I hope you'll comment. Thank you to the many who have been, but post your thoughts on the website or the Facebook page, or as many have been, personal message me. And again, at the end of the project, I'll turn what we learned together into a book. So let's begin with this week's episode titled Sexuality Interrupted, A Story. Now, I said in the last episode that we'd turn this week to how sex got dirty in the Christian tradition, and we will get to that, but I received several messages after the last couple of episodes, and reading through them, I thought it would be good to tell a story to help clarify these stages of progressive sexuality I've been speaking of, and in particular this week to clarify the pragma stage of love. It's a story about what happens when we don't give adequate attention to the attachment dimension of our sexuality. That's what the Greeks were talking about when they used that term pragma and they framed that idea. So again, in the last couple of episodes, we've arranged five ancient Greek conceptions of love into a layered and progressive framework. Mania, the Greek word for the head-over-heels experience we call falling in love, mania comes first. Then eros, the Greek idea of eroticism, romance, sexual attraction. Then philos, their word for friendship, for the non-sexual dimension of love. And the one we're less familiar with, pragma, love that forms attachments, love hammered out as we build lives together. In pragma love, we create lives that are no longer your life and no longer my life, but our life. And then finally, the capstone of this sexuality journey, the Greeks called that agape love. This is the love of the elder, the love that is given freely, given without regard to the actions or responsiveness of the beloved, simply because it has become the nature of the lover to love. So our sexuality draws us with a certain relentlessness toward a love that just is, that has become the character of the lover. So, in these five stages, we saw that there is a one after another way in which we deepen our experience of love that lasts for a lifetime. The first stages, we saw, have a strong chemical component, and they are given plenty of attention in our culture. The pragma stage, the attachment stage, is often shortchanged in the way that our society frames sexuality. In our use a sex to sell stuff approach to sex education, the mundane everyday life part of sexuality, that doesn't really sell. In fact, we've kind of redefined the very word sexy to refer to things that grab us right now, that grab us right here with immediacy. According to that version of sexy, the pragma stage isn't sexy at all. It isn't even love. Creating a budget together, how is that love? Setting up our housing together, balancing competing careers together, deciding how we'll eat and sleep and shop and work, the nuts and bolts pragmatism of life in our society, that's not even in the category sexy. So what, many people ask, what were the Greeks talking about when they made it part of this unfolding stage of sexuality? So in today's episode, I'm going to tell a story. It's a story about a couple whose sexual journey was interrupted right at the stage of pragma love. It's a story I've heard many times, but when I heard it in my conversation with Jack and Jackie, not their real names, of course, when I heard this 3 to 4 years ago, it still stands out in my mind. And their story goes like this. Jack and Jackie met in college, and before meeting, they had both dated enough to know the disappointment of being with someone who's not a fit. So when they found one another, and when they fell head over heels in love with one another, and when they discovered how much they had in common, how much they shared values, how they finished one another's sentences, when the chemistry sparks were flying between them, they were delighted. They were delighted at their good fortune to have found someone for whom they felt so deeply and someone who had so much in sync with their own life, their own goals. That was just a treat. So they experienced with one another what so many do, the rush of love chemicals that intoxicate and excite us, the flood of vasopressin and oxytocin that we spoke about in the last episode. And they experienced that rush in the deepest, the reptilian part of their brains. They experienced what the Greeks called mania and eros, what we call falling in love or eroticism. And it was fun. And it was exciting. And it motivated them to move heaven and earth to be with one another. And they experienced all the stuff that the early stages of love have to offer. And as they were finishing up their college years, Jack and Jackie were about as smart as 22, 23-year-olds can be. So even in the throes of their great passion, they stood back from the whirlwind long enough to assess their relationship. And they did their best to be cautious and to be sensible and to be prudent. They did their best to assess their relationship in the cool light of day because, like many, they had been seen divorce in their lives. They'd watched their parents crash and burn their own marriages. So they put considerable energy into weighing their chances for relational success. And they concluded that their chances were good. They both reported to me when we spoke later on that as they were finishing up their college years, that they had come to this conclusion, hey, we hardly ever fight, and that's got to be a good sign. And even when we do, we move on pretty quickly. We aren't like our parents with all of their constant bickering, their constant fighting. No, we don't have much relational conflict at all. And so we both concluded, they said, our chances are good. Our chances are really good. And so, out of college, beginning their careers, they moved in together. They got an apartment together, which felt like a really big step. And they moved deeper into the Greek stages of love. They immersed themselves in both Eros and Philos. Their friendship blossomed. They began to enjoy one another's strengths and begin to support one another with them. When they saw one another's weaknesses, they were patient. Things were so good between them that flaws or weaknesses just weren't worth making a deal over. And they explored deeply their own erotic love. As the fire of mania became more manageable, the slow burn of sexual attraction kicked in, and they probed one another's bodies, sharing the joy of erotic love. They learned the skills required to heighten sexual pleasure, and they stoked the romantic fire that burned slow with the comforting warmth, and it stayed that way. For years, it stayed that way. Years 1 and 2 and 3, things were good. Years 4 and 5, things were still good. Each time, they'd take an assessment of their relationship, and they'd keep affirming their earlier conclusion. Still not much conflict. We're clearly not in the toxic spiral of fighting and hurt that we watched our parents go through, so it's good. It's all good. Same thing in year 6. Except that in that year, a few of the conflicts that had been able to be brushed away wouldn't brush like they used to. A few more conflicts, some didn't get resolved, but that's okay because they had accumulated enough goodwill along the way that the unresolved issues, they could just let them go. But by year 7, the volatility and the frequency of their conflicts, along with the accumulated resentments that had come from those unresolved issues, those combined together to make a super wave of troubles. And all of a sudden, shouting, which hadn't been part of their life together, and hurt, and anger, and offense, these things begin to crop up in their relationship. And they could both see the handwriting on the wall. We were never like our parents, but now we are. We never sounded like our friends who were getting divorces, but now we do. And it's a shame and it's a loss, but it is clearly time to pull the plug, they both concluded. We better get out now before this thing heads down that road that we swore we would never go down. And it was shortly after the plug pulling that I spoke with them. He had moved out, and he came to speak to me first. She came a couple weeks later. They both thought that they had done the only reasonable thing. They both spoke of having avoided the biggest mistake of their lives. And they were both convinced of the rightness of their decision. But they were also, as you can understand, in a great deal of pain. Of course, they were suffering the loss that comes when we lose something that we had once had that was precious, but there was something else that was causing pain in them, and it was a deep sense that they both shared of an opportunity that had been lost. There had been an opening into the deeper desires of the human heart, but that opening had closed. There had been a chance for something magical, something mystical, something divine even, but it seemed to have eluded them. Now, as I said, Jack and Jackie are about as smart as people come. And dead convinced as they were that they had dodged a bullet, nevertheless, they both had the insight to pay attention to that quiet voice speaking within them. They both had the insight to pay attention to that interior whisper, because there was within both of them that echo of the ancient wisdom we've been speaking about. And that quiet echo was rattling around in their souls. There is something about love, they concluded, that can go further than this. Even as they were convinced that this was the only right thing to do, that nagging little voice inside kept asking, did I miss something? Should I be suspect of my instincts? And so we spoke over the next few weeks. And I asked a bunch of questions, and I listened carefully for what they were saying and what their interior voices were telling them. And then I fed back to them what I heard, along with some of the experience I've gained over time. And one of the things that I learned as I was asking my questions was this, that they'd been able to coordinate the complete dissolution of their 8-year relationship. They'd been able to do that whole thing in a weekend. Because all along, they'd had separate bank accounts, they'd had separate jobs, separate possessions. The couch and the desk were the only things of value that they'd bought together, so each one took one of them. So on Friday, Jack looked for an apartment, and on Saturday, he loaded up his possessions and he moved out. By the end of the week, after 8 years, both had replaced the missing desk and the couch, and life was moving on, seemingly without a hiccup. So I said back to them what I'd heard them say. A couple of things, I said. Tell me if this is true. Even though you lived together for 8 years, your lives during that time were pretty separate from one another. From a practical standpoint, you were able to move out and move on without much of an interruption to your lives. There wasn't any wrangling over money. That's a common thing. No negotiating over property. You didn't squabble over the drinking cups or who got the dog. Your lives over these last 8 years have been pretty unentangled with one another. And a second thing, I said, a second thing you told me is that there weren't many fights for the years of your life together. No knockdown dragouts over these epic power struggles, no money struggles, no hurt feelings over sex. These are the kinds of things most couples fight about, but you didn't. So let me suggest this possibility, I said, that the reason you didn't fight is because you didn't have to. You didn't have to have power struggle fights because in an unentangled life, everybody gets to keep their own power. You didn't have to have money fights because in an unentangled life, everybody gets to make their own money decisions. You didn't have many sex fights because you were still young, early in your life together, and all that built-in male-female libido difference gets smoothed out by low stress and an abundance of sex chemicals in our bodies. So you didn't have much conflict because you didn't have to. But here's the thing about sexuality unfolding over a lifetime. The thing about sexuality, as we've seen in previous episodes, I was telling them, is that it can't be reduced down to just eroticism. The thing about this bigger picture sexuality is that it actually includes struggle. In fact, sexuality can breed struggle. Struggle is baked right into the sexual journey. It's only the first and the last stages of our unfolding sexuality that present themselves as conflict-free. Mania is pretty conflict because our brains do this crazy-making thing to get us on the train. In the early stages of mania love, the beloved can do no wrong. So yeah, that stage is pretty conflict-free. And you'd think Eros would be too, except that usually it's males and females who experience erotic love together, and males and female sexuality, they're very different. Baked into Eros are huge, profound differences. We have different ways that our bodies are aroused. We have different ways that we experience pleasure. We desire different pacing in our sexuality. We assign different meaning to all the parts of sexual experience. And so even the erotic stage of unfolding sexuality has conflict built into it. In the Philos stage of love, the friendship stage, we have to resolve power conflicts. If we get close enough in our friendships, we have to work out together who decides what we'll do and who decides when we'll do it. We have to work out how to relate when we can't agree. Friendship love has to grapple over different meanings that we assign to words or to actions. Philos love forces us to work out together the conflicts that are embedded in two people sharing life's journey together. But none of these struggles of these earlier stages of the love journey, none of them compare to the struggle of pragma love. By its very nature, pragma love is conflicted. It's not my life that we are creating together. It's not your life we are creating together. It is our life that we are hammering out together. So neither one of us is going to get everything that we want. each of us has to give up something in order to have this new life, this life that we now think of as ours. In pragma love, we have to have money fights because we have to decide what we're going to do with money together. We have to have where we'll live and whose job will we move for and who pays the bills. We have to have these kinds of fights because I used to have it my way. Now we have to create our way. We have to figure out who cleans the toilets and what are the rules for staying late at work. And embedded in creating this new entity that we call our life, embedded in creating pragma love, is struggle. Creating a life that's not yours and not mine, it's a messy affair. A messy affair in which everybody has to give up something. It's a messy affair in which competition for getting what I want, you getting what you want, is built right into the process. Now again, as I said in an earlier episode, the brilliant insight of the Greeks was to call this messy, this demanding, this conflicted process, to call it love. Their brilliance was to afford this very mundane human endeavor the status of one of the stages of love in a lifetime of unfolding sexuality. So, I said to Jack and Jackie, you did mania love pretty well. Good for you. And it sounds like erotic love and friendship love, high marks all around. But, I reviewed for them, both of those loves are episodic. They come, they go. They wax, they wane. They ebb, they flow. And often, around year 7 in a relationship, they go. That's the time they begin to wane. That's the season when they ebb. 7 years is often the time when accumulated resentments start to boil over. That's when you can't avoid conflict anymore. Up until then, you could sweep the struggle under the rug. We would just let our bad feelings evaporate over time. And bad feelings will evaporate, but when they do, they leave a residue. And that residue accumulates over time. And often around year 7, it has pretty much filled up our hearts. So now conflict won't stay under the rug when we sweep it. Our emotions come out, and they get loud, and they get harsh. The backlog of swept away, unresolved hurts, now it has to be dealt with. And so, I told them, you experienced what many couples do. Things really hit the fan somewhere around year 7. At that time, mania love has settled down. It's just a low boil. Eroticism is doing what it does by then. It's coming and going. It's waxing and waning. Philos is doing the same. It's ebbing and flowing. They will come back again, and they will be magical when they do. But they need an additional form of love to hold them. And, the Greeks understood, that supporting form of love is pragma. As we build our lives together, we form attachments with one another that help us weather our relational storms. When mania settles down, sometimes way down, when we don't feel erotic or even friendly toward our partner, we are still attached to the life that we have built together. And those attachments sustain us when our partner hurts us deeply, when emotions flare, when spite gets spiteful. Even then, we're still deeply attached to the life that we created together. The sheer painfulness of untangling ourselves from our lives, it indirectly attaches us to our partner. It attaches us to the environment, to the relationship-building, sexuality-unfolding environment. And it holds us steady in this environment for the process that carries us along the sexuality journey. The entangled lives that we create in the pragma stage of love give us a place where eroticism can return when it ebbs and flows, where friendship can return when it ebbs and flows, a place that those can be sustained over a lifetime in their coming and going nature. Now, the instinct that Jack and Jackie were following is an instinct that a lot of people follow. Not having seen the end game or not having even been told about the end game, they had only been taught about mania, philos, and eros. And they were overrun by mania early on, but they didn't know what comes next. So, of course, uninformed by the end game, they did what makes sense. They protected themselves from loss. and more than that, uninformed by sexuality's in-game, being taught only the sex sells curriculum, like more and more people, they actually arranged their lives together so that they could avoid pragma love. Why would we entangle our lives with someone else when it's so dangerous? Look around at the divorce rate. Look around at the hurt married people cause one another. Why would we entangle our lives with someone? Why would we limit our options by pinning our lives together with someone else? Why would we paint ourselves into a corner and entangle ourselves with this other person? Uninformed by the process, especially uninformed by the end game and how you get there, it just makes no sense to limit our options. But when we are informed by the end game, and when we do know why, we begin to change our perspective. Why would you do this thing? You do it because, as important as mania is to bond us, it settles down after a while. Why would you do this? Because Eros and Philos, they come and they go. Why would you do this? Because sexuality's destination is agape love. Why would you do this? Because eventually our penises and our vaginas are not big enough containers for fully expressing human sexuality. Why would we do this? Because the ancient wisdom points us toward a lifetime of evolutionary developmental stage love, and pragma is one of the necessary parts of love supporting this overall process. And it is a part that our current version of sex education is ignoring. I was recently reading a story, and in that story, an older woman was speaking to a younger one, speaking about the young woman's marital troubles. And in the course of the conversation, the older woman said something like this, something I don't think I would have understood when I was younger. "Ah, honey," she said, "4 years of trouble is nothing in the life of a marriage. 4 years of trouble is nothing in the life of a marriage. But I will tell you, when you're in the midst of four difficult years, and when you're trying to and failing at making a shared life, when you're in the throes of this demanding stage of love, 4 years is an eternity. 4 years is a daily scream to make the pain stop. 4 years is a prison. It's a stint in the slammer. And nobody in their right mind would go to that painful place willingly unless they understood the prize on the other side. Unless they understood that there is a dimension of love that is even deeper and more fulfilling and more satisfying than eroticism or friendship. They wouldn't go there unless they understood that a shared life, despite all of the trouble it creates and all the demands that it puts upon us, a shared life deepens our experience of love." Now, the entanglements that we create as we craft our shared lives, the entanglements that we create when we step into pragma love, attachment love, these entanglements are tough. Pragma is, in fact, the real tough love. It's difficult to see what it will be like on the other side of this demanding process. Pragma love makes our love, forces our love to be an all-in affair. It makes it an in-with-both-feet affair. It demands that we get all in and do so before we have seen the results of what happens when we do. We don't know up front that mania will settle down over time. We don't know up front that the chemicals will ebb and flow. We don't know up front that friendship will wax and wane. We don't know that the demanding process of creating shared life attachments is what we are going to need to carry us through the ups and downs of love's earlier stages. We don't know that our life, the life that we create together, will hold us steady and anchor us through the stormy times. The really difficult part about entering the pragma love stage of the journey is that we have to take someone else's word for it. Somebody who is further along on the journey. Someone who tells us that this entangling stage of our sexuality will carry us through the difficult times. We have to trust someone. And in our society, in our culture, there are very few that we can trust. We don't realize that pragma will carry us to the full flowering of our sexuality, to the end game that is our heart's deepest desire. Again, the brilliance of the Greeks was to see how everyday practical this side of life is in fact a powerful stage in the creation of the deepest love, the love into which our sexuality is inexorably drawing us. Well, Jack and Jackie's story does not have a tidy ending. The story of love developing through several stages over a lifetime, that was brand new to Jack and Jackie. They never heard such a thing. And so when we spoke, that was the first time that they'd heard that daily life practicalities actually support the journey of love. They had no concept of an evolutionary sexuality, no concept of the ebb and flow of friendship and eroticism. They didn't know that when eroticism is gone, it will come back. They didn't know that when friendship has been battered, it will be back. They didn't know that mania that had quieted down inside of them would hold them through the progressive stages of love. When Eros and Philos were gone, they assumed love was just over. And so they had no idea about difficulty being baked right into a shared life. And they didn't understand that the struggles and the conflicts that are part of making a shared life could be resolved and that they could come out the other side. That's not what their parents had modeled for them. For them, the very idea embedded in pragma is a pipe dream. For them, if conflict is part of creating our life, then I guess we won't have our life because conflict is an unending struggle. That's what they had seen with their parents' lives. It's better in their minds just to hold on to my life and your life and keep them separate. It's better to just try and hold on to Philos as long as we can and to hold on to Eros as long as we can. Because their sex education had left them uninformed. Their lives were limited because their sex education was uninformed. Their sexual journey could only take them so far because their sex education was uninformed. And so, in the end, sadly, Jack and Jackie both succumbed to being another statistic. They hit the average lifespan of a relationship in our society, 8 years. They hit it, but they didn't go any further. Their experience of love was limited. They experienced mania, and they experienced Philos, and they experienced Eros, but they never experienced pragma love or the capstone agape love. Because the sex education given them didn't prepare them for a bigger vision of sexuality. Their sex education didn't prepare them for the fickle nature of eroticism, the fickle nature of friendship. Their education didn't prepare them for the hard work required to experience all that sexuality has to offer. And we can do better for our young people. We have to do better for our young people. We can teach them about the whole process. We can do better than the marketers are doing. We can talk to them about the expansiveness of lifetime love. We can prepare them to be on the lookout for the magic of mania, and we can warn them that Eros and Philos will come and go, and we can teach them the work and the commitment that is required to nurture this lifetime kind of love. We can model for them how the struggle doesn't have to end love, but can actually be a necessary part of moving love forward. We can show them what day in, day out shared responsibility can look like, and we can teach them the giving and the taking, that these are also an expression of our sexuality. We can do better for our young people. We can give them the whole picture. We can inform them. So that's enough for today. I've been getting a lot of emails and personal messages about the stage progression way of thinking about our sexuality, so I want to do one more episode along these lines before we get to the next point. The next point will be how sex got dirty and how Western Christianity was culpable in the process. So we'll pick up there next time. Again, thanks for listening, and I hope you'll comment.